Before I came to you about a podcast, did you know what a podcast was?
No, I had no idea what a podcast was.
And now you're Mr. Spotify all over it.
You know, one thing I noticed that a lot of women are the ones that are writing in, you know, and I find that really amusing because you would think that it'd be a whole bunch of guys, you know, it's a guy thing, really, you know, smuggling and shot at airplanes, Lamborghinis, yeah. You know.
I'm Jonathan Walton, and this is Cocaine Air, the TJ Dominguez story, episode 10, Flying with Princes.
I'm finding that I'm actually pleased to see some of the comments that some of these women are writing. And I'm not talking about anything romantic, just their view, the fact that they take the time and they're analyzing it.
The Cocaine Air podcast has made TJ's life public in a way that he could have never imagined. His past is now present.
So I buried that for a long time. I didn't want to talk about my past. My own two sons, I've never sat down with them to talk about my past.
TJ's two sons are now strapping, handsome, successful men in their 30s. But TJ was serving time behind bars for a lot of their childhood.
They had no idea. They knew that I was in prison. It was no secret. But whatever they knew, either my ex-wife told them, which, by the way, I have to give a shout out from the point of view or kudos to my wife. She was the first to come and visit and the last to leave. And she closed down my house and moved in with my mom.
When you got arrested.
Yeah, and I had a beautiful big house, you know, and she said, I don't need all that space. I'm gonna move in with your mom. And my mom had a very nice home. So she moved in with my mom. She never went to a party. And when people would invite her to even go to a family gathering party, she would always say, I got nothing to celebrate until my husband comes home. And she stood by my side. She was, I think, 18 or 19 years old. So for the record, people that say too young, too old, too this, too that, let me tell you, if they're going to two-time you, it'll happen in jail or out of jail. When they're good, they're good. When the heart's in the right place, no mountain can move it.
Yeah. And this was April 1988, you got busted.
Yeah, for the record, her name is Veronique.
we can give a shout-out to Veronique. Yeah. So Veronique stood by you. For
like,
years.
Like an angel. My wife supported me. Everybody supported me. They didn't condone it. They didn't agree. The ones that worried me were my two boys, you know, because kids sometimes can be cruel. You know, oh, yeah, daddy's in prison, you know, and I know it had to have been very hard. And I know that because, I mean, I don't want to get all choked up, but my wife would bring my boys to visit, the one boy. And boy, I tell you what, the hardest thing I've ever did in life is when we had to say goodbye. He grabbed me around the neck and wouldn't want to go. Tough, really, really tough.
TJ's sons are all grown up now, and they're married with kids and careers. And TJ is a grandfather. And how many grandkids do you have now?
I got five.
Five grandkids.
Yeah, they're all unbelievable. They're all postcard kids. You know,
yeah, I saw the pictures on the wall. It's
beautiful.
It really is, like a Macy's catalog.
Good DNA.
Good DNA. But TJ's sons are his perpetual pride and joy. He dotes on them endlessly.
They're just great, great kids, you know, and they've done a lot of great stuff in their own right.
And you're close to your sons.
Very close to them.
You guys talk every day.
Every day. And we do a lot of WhatsApp pictures, back and forth, videos. Problem I have with a podcast, I did what I did and I live with it, right? So it's a cross that I bear, I get that. But I didn't want this to cross over to them.
Right.
So they have a different last name, which is the maiden name of my wife. One of my sons got drafted by Buffalo Sabres. Hockey player. He led the nation in scoring and all that kind of crazy stuff.
Wow.
And then the other one also. And he didn't lead the nation, but let me tell you, he doesn't fall far behind him. And he's the more daring one, the smaller one.
When I had initially contacted TJ about doing this podcast a couple years ago, he checked with his boys first.
I went and I asked them, I've got an opportunity of doing this and doing that. How do you guys feel about it? Because that would be my only concern, you know? And then they say, hey, listen, Dad, something that you did? I never talked to them about this. They knew I was in prison, so it was no secret, but they didn't know if it was because of why I was in prison. I don't know what my ex-wife, the mother of the children, she didn't like sugarcoating anything. I just don't know how much she told them, because it was not a topic that I wanted to engage in anyway. You know, prison is something that I didn't talk
and
about.
And so what do your boys think? Have they heard the podcast?
Yes, they have.
And
yes,
what is the reaction?
The reaction is I have one that's a sheriff. He's a policeman.
No, your son is a sheriff.
Yeah. He's sharing it with his other fellow officers.
He's proud.
Well, I'm surprised of that.
And you shouldn't be.
Yeah. The jury's out on that. I don't even know how to address it. I can only repeat what he told me. And I said, why would you share that with them? And aren't you, you know, doesn't that kind of put you in like in a difficult situation? He goes, no. He says, they think you're super cool. They even said, your dad is really, really cool. Our dad is boring. He said, can you make an arrangement? We'll fly down to Florida and meet this guy? He's amazing. Well,
no, his fellow officers are fans.
Yeah, oh yeah, yeah. One's a DEA agent, the other one's an officer.
Oh my God.
Now that we're condoning this, and I don't even know how
they
view it.
Again, that's what I tell people. It's like, I'm just trying to explain how you got here.
Yeah.
And what happened as a result. Like, this is the truth of, you know, you never meant to become a drug smuggler. That was never your plan. You pled guilty, you did your time, and it just sounds like a hellish existence all those years, going from prison to prisons.
It wasn't just prison to prison. People think this and that. But let me tell you, I did hard time.
It sounds like it.
I did a hard time.
The life of a cocaine smuggler, making millions of dollars every week, is grand. TJ would fly to Europe all the time because a lot of his money was stashed in Switzerland. And he'd also visit the Lamborghini factory in Italy frequently. And when TJ flies to Europe, he doesn't fly in a regular plane. He takes the Concorde. One of the things I missed out on in life, I never got to take the Concorde.
Oh, yeah.
The Concorde was a supersonic passenger jet that was in service from the 1970s to the early 2000s. British Airways used them, as did Air France, flying at more than 1,300 miles an hour, nearly twice the speed of sound. The Concorde could get you from New York to London in 3.5 hours. As opposed to the nearly 8 hours it takes a regular commercial flight.
I wish you a safe and pleasant onward journey, and thank you for choosing the British Airways Concorde.
But when runway debris causes an Air France Concorde to suddenly burst into flame shortly after takeoff from Charles de Gaulle Airport in July of 2000,
the world's most prestigious aircraft crashes. More than 100 people are dead.
The Concorde gets retired from service in 2003, forever. The days of the Concorde, Air France had one, British Airways had one.
Well, it's the same airplane. It was backed by Air France and British Air.
Oh.
14 planes that were built by Airbus.
And they would share them?
Yeah, well, what it was they each took 7.
Okay. So there are 14 Concordes total.
Yeah.
God, how do you know all this?
Because I flew a goddamn thing probably twice a month sometimes.
Because you could get from New York to London
in three and a half hours.
3.5 hours. Because now regularly it's like, what, 7, 8?
10 or 11, depending on the winds.
And back then, tickets were like $12,000
each. Yeah, crazy tickets.
Which is the equivalent of like $30,000, $40,000 in today's money for a plane ticket, but you're getting there super fast.
I've had a lot of great experiences in the Concorde because I think it's either 112 or I think it's around 112 passengers. It's two rows.
Right. It's narrow.
Very narrow, and there's no first class, second class.
Right.
It's one class, Concorde class.
Now we quickly go supersonic, passing through Mach 1, the speed of sound, at about 30,000 feet.
The airplane grows and expands in flight, I think like 12, 13, 14 inches. I'm just going off of
like
memory
the metal
right now.
Stretches?
Yeah, yeah. Tremendous feat of engineer.
Oh, my
God. Yeah, and the windows are really small, and you know, the plane's going to expand. So this thing's got to flex and allow so this window glass doesn't fall out when you're doing 1,400 miles per hour. You know, so it's pretty crazy. So, yeah, and then the airplane is very flexible. On the ground, it goes like this, like a noodle. Actually,
really?
Yeah, you see the floor kind of like...
You see the floor move during
flight? Well, not like quicksand, but yeah, it's a plane, it's long,
yeah.
And it's like a long noodle, you know, and you will actually see a flexing on the floor.
It reminds me of like those skyscrapers. There's one in LA, the Intercontinental. It's built to sway.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
like
yeah.
The whole
yeah.
building yeah, and you know, sways that, with the wind.
And you know, beyond that, it's also built with a break point. So the whole building doesn't go down.
Yeah.
At a certain point, it'll snap off. So if you're up in there, guys, take up base jumping.
Yeah.
Keep in mind, everyone flying on the Concorde is super rich. They're the people who can afford to spend $35,000 in today's money on a single ticket. So just know that whoever is sitting beside you on the Concorde could be someone really important. Okay, so I've never been a huge weed person, mostly because I think dispensaries are a little overwhelming and pretentious. That's just me. You do you. But there's this company called Mood, Mood.com, that's changing the way people can buy cannabis. You know how most dispensaries make you choose between strains with ridiculous names and you have no idea which one's for you? Well, that's what Mood.com figured out. And by the way, you can get 20% off your first order with promo code Walton. If you go to Mood.com and click Shop by Mood, it'll tell you which strain does what. Want to be more social at a party? There's a flower for that. Need to focus and get work done? There's a flower for that. Want to melt into your couch and watch movies? Yep, there's a flower for that too. And here's the part few people realize. It's now 100% federally legal to have really great bud shipped right to your door. It's third-party lab tested and arrives in a discreet box. Best of all, everything's backed by Mood's 100-day satisfaction guarantee. And like I said, you can get 20% off with code Walton. So head to Mood.com and get 20% off your first order now. Now, this show is brought to you by BetterHelp. We talk about mental health more openly now, but asking for help can still feel hard, and BetterHelp's latest research confirms it. BetterHelp's 2026 State of Stigma report surveyed 2,000 Americans and revealed that 85% of them believe getting support is wise, yet 74% say society discourages people from doing so. With more than 30,000 therapists, BetterHelp is the world's largest online therapy platform, and it works with an average rating of 4.9 out of 5 for a live session. BetterHelp does the initial matching work for you, so you can focus on your therapy goals. A short questionnaire helps identify your needs and preferences. And their 12 plus years of experience and industry-leading match fulfillment rate means they typically get it right the first time. Don't let stigma stand in the way of support. Start therapy with BetterHelp. Sign up and get 10% off at BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp.com.
I'm sitting next to the Asian guy. I guess it would be the proper thing to say now. Guy's from Japan. I want to be correct. You know, it's like, I don't know. I mean, I used to say Oriental.
You know, I know,
Oriental.
But that's, you can't say that.
Yeah.
Right. So Asian. Asian is.
It's like,
is,
I have to learn a whole new language, right? When I come home. Asian. So, yeah. But he's really a nice guy. And he's sitting next to me, and we're side by side. The seats are small, and there's two over there and two over here, and you have the walkway. Back in those days, they didn't close the cockpit, right? So you got the engineer, you got a couple, two, three people up there. And really great airplane, I loved it. I'm sitting here next to this guy, and so I introduce myself, he introduces himself to me, and his name is Hirito, and I'm Tito. So Tito Ito. So it's kind of like, oh, that's pretty funny. Where are you from? He says, I'm from Japan. So I said, oh, Japan. I said, I learned karate, you know? And he spoke kind of broken English, so now I'm speaking broken English back to him so he can understand me, right? It's really funny. You shouldn't even talk like that. It's just dumb. But anyway, I am karate from Okinawa, which is an island, and that's the scrolls of paper that I was taught by, you know? And I met Shimiboku, which is my sensei from Okinawa. So I got a little connection there. You know, I even learned how to count in Japanese and all this kind of stuff, years and stuff. The guy's got like three or four cameras on him, right? Little camera. Typical tourist you expect to come from, you know, cameras were really a popular thing in Japan. You got the Nikon or whatever, you know. So I say, yeah, karate. So I go, boom, I throw a punch and I stomp it right on his nose, right? Just touch his nose. It goes, ah, very good. I say, yeah, control. You know, I love, you know, martial arts from Okinawa, you know. And we're bonding. And, oh, let's take a picture. Okay, let's take a picture, Ito. So now, hey, stewardess, can you take a picture of Tito and Ito? So so we're there. I got my arm around Ito, you know. And so we're there like this, and snap, 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 taking some pictures. Okay. And it wasn't back in the day of cell phones or anything like that. We send me the copies. No, these are real cameras. So, all right, so, okay, you're gonna get off here? Yeah, well, I'm gonna continue to Miami. The Concorde, when it flew back down, it would stop off the leg in Washington, D.C., and then it went to Miami. Only flew 2 days a week, Thursdays and Tuesday. So I said, well, I'm gonna continue to Miami. Okay, Ito, okay, get a hug. We hug each other. Okay, oh, I love you, Ito. Okay, bye-bye. So I get off the plane. When you're on the Concorde, you're in transit, you don't deplane, you deplane, but here's how the deplane thing works. You're in the middle of the tarmacs out there, Concorde pulls off to the side, and this bus comes up and it races itself up, because the Concorde is really, really high, and it just hooks up to the door of the Concorde. So now you deplane to stretch your legs, and it's really like, maybe not even business class. Seats are pretty damn small. So now I get off the airplane, and this bus is laid out like a club. It got like a center horseshoe, good looking stewardesses. They're passing out the bubbly stuff, whatever you want to drink, you know. Concorde class. And so I go and get myself, you know, a drink, and it's all bus windows. The whole bus is full of windows. So you're looking at the whole airport. You know, you're in transit. And so I'm leaning back, and I've got my drink in my hand. And as I'm leaning back, I see a motorcade pull up, right? So I say, oh, okay, cool. You know, and I see 2-3 motorcycles in front, a couple motorcycles in back, and I see the big black limo with flags on the hood. So I look at the flag, and I said, shit, got the Japanese flag on there. And Ito's getting in the limo. What's Ito doing getting in that limo? So I said, stewardess, come here a sec. I said, what's my buddy Ito doing getting in the limo? And she goes, don't you know who that is? I said, yeah, my buddy Ito. He goes, no, that's the emperor's son, which is now today the emperor of Japan.
So now he's the emperor of Japan.
Yeah, my buddy. It's the guy that I punched in the nose. And we're taking pictures together. Hirito or something like that is his name.
As the new era dawned in the land of the rising sun, Emperor Naruhito was gearing up for his formal ascension.
Have you talked to him since?
No, I mean, I lost touch with him.
I'm sure he'd remember
friends.
You.
Well, hell, I mean, how many people on an airplane can punch you in the nose?
Stop at the nose.
God, TJ was actually sitting beside the then prince, now emperor of Japan, and he had no idea. And then, on another flight, not the Concorde, just first class of a regular airline, TJ discovers his seatmate is another super important person. A cultural icon, really. But TJ has no idea.
Good afternoon. This is your captain speaking.
So I'm sitting there, and they sit me next to this other guy. Well, the other guy that I'm with, he's got, you know what a boa is? A feather kind of like long thing. You know, this thing is like 10 feet long. He's got this purple boa around him, and he's dressed like in a mechanic outfit with a zipper right in the front, and it's purple. Guy's a little weird, right? And he's got platform shoes that are probably 8 inches. Well, I'm not really feeling comfortable because the guy's not even talking. He's like really kind of weird. So he, excuse me. And so he's gonna go to the bathroom or something, right? So he goes to the bathroom, so I say, stewardess, come here. I said, who's the weirdo that you sent me down to? Can you move me? And she goes, I don't know yet. I don't know if there's gonna be, you know, the seats are booked and this and that. So I said, well, who is this guy? And she goes, well, that's Prince. So having had the experience of Ito, who is the son's emperor to the son of, I'm the emperor of Japan, I say, and I say this really very naive, I say to the stewardess, okay, he's a prince, prince of what country? And she goes, country? What are you talking about? He's prince. I said, yeah, I heard that. Prince of what country? And she goes, not a country. Prince, you know, the singer, Purple Haze.
Purple Rain.
Purple Rain, whatever. Oh, that prince. So I sat with him for about 3.5 hours.
First class, heading to Minneapolis. Yeah.
And I didn't know who he was.
So did you talk to him
after?
Yeah,
I talked to very little.
And what kind of, and did he, what, was he nicer?
He whispered a lot. He's not very talkative.
No, he's not. He's really not.
You know, wow, but we were okay. Prince. I didn't even ask to move afterwards.
Yeah.
Because he was okay, and I didn't want to insult him.
Right.
Because I thought that if I moved, he might take that. Not that I really give a damn, but I didn't want to make him feel like, well, he's moving because I'm not a few, he feels uncomfortable next to
right.
me. There's nothing uncomfortable about him. I just thought he was a little weird with a purple outfit, purple boa, purple platform shoes, boots.
I mean, he's not trying to lie low. Like,
oh, there's nothing. This guy was,
he was putting on a
center.
Show.
Oh, yeah.
With a boa.
Who has a boa that's this big around? Listen, Jonathan, this thing was this big around.
If you board a plane with a boa,
10-foot boa. It wasn't like a little.
Yeah.
It was like an anaconda. What's this guy? I said, who's the weird guy that's next to me?
Yeah.
And she goes, Prince.
Prince of what country?
I felt kind of stupid when I said that afterwards. She goes, not a country.
No, but in your defense, you had the Ito experience.
Yeah, so I thought, well, the
guy. Another prince.
Another prince from someplace. I mean.
So while TJ is rubbing shoulders with literal and figurative princes, in the 1980s, President Ronald Reagan's war on drugs is heating up.
37 federal agencies are working together in a vigorous national effort. And by next year, our spending for drug law enforcement will have more than tripled. Last year alone, over 10,000 drug criminals were convicted, and nearly $250 million of their assets were seized by the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Administration.
Paradox of paradoxes, Ronald Reagan's war on drugs helped you sell more cocaine.
Absolutely.
How could that be true? They're marshaling billions of dollars, dozens of agencies to go after cocaine in particular. How did it help your business?
The way I looked at it, we were very, very good at what we did. I created a division for intelligence to survey them,
right.
Find out about them, what they were up to. I created a transport division on land. I created a security division, which then advised me, radios, better communication. Well, a lot of these guys that were out there, they were like, you know, hit and miss type thing. So I considered them to be amateurs. Guys that are out there, let's go make a fast buck. You know, I got a guy, a friend of mine's got an airplane. I got another guy's got a boat. Let's go hit it. So we considered ourselves that elite. What Reagan was doing was fighting the war on drugs. Yeah, arrest the son of a bitches. After all, it was too much cocaine out there in the street. It's going to lower the price. Get weed out the amateurs. That was our view on things.
Weed out the amateurs. So that made the cocaine. So the amateurs are getting busted.
Yeah.
And that makes your cocaine more valuable.
That's right.
Because now you're one of the only games in town.
Instead of having 10 people doing it, now we maybe have 4 or 5. And what happens? We're controlling more of the market.
Yeah.
And that's the way we looked at it. I mean, I wasn't going out and arresting anybody. I'm not a cop. I'm not an agent. I don't give a damn about that. But yeah, bring in more agents. Make it harder. You know, weed out the amateurs.
Yeah.
These guys are flying in balls to the wall, you know, on a speedboat. I've got surveillance team on the coast. You know, I'm becoming a real master at what I do.
And something I did not know about cocaine, the price can be extremely volatile.
I've seen cocaine, a kilo of pure cocaine, which I didn't want to put it out there at that time because I would go through too much trouble to sell a kilo of cocaine in Miami for $9,000.
Yeah.
But I've also seen cocaine for $78,000.
A kilo.
A kilo. Denver.
It's like the stock market. It goes up, it goes down.
Exactly.
You buy low, you sell high.
And back in the 80s, there was nothing coming in through California or Texas. Everything came in through Florida.
Yeah.
Nobody was working the West Coast. So that meant that for cocaine to hit Denver or LA, it had to come in through here and then travel through here across everyone. Every time it went through our state, or if you didn't speak Spanish, it just went up another 2,000. They were crazy days.
Yeah.
And it was party atmosphere. And life was a lot simpler back then, believe it or not. It's a lot more fun, too.
Especially for TJ. He had so much money and was running so many other profitable businesses simultaneously that in 1988, he started to put cocaine smuggling in the rearview mirror.
When they arrested you in April of 1988, you were getting out of the business.
I was out of the business.
You were out of the business.
Yeah, I had wound down my business and I had made arrangements. Pablo and them didn't want me to quit because, you know.
You told Pablo, I want out, and what did he say?
Yeah, I told him, I said, you know, I've had it. And at one time, Jonathan, I would have done this smuggling thing for even no money. And I have to tell you, I started out for $14 million for the sugar mill, and then I got caught up in the whole excitement, the whole adrenaline of things. I got caught up in it. I actually lived it, loved it, and enjoyed it because it was a thrill to go out there. I don't do drugs, so maybe it was a drug, feeling this adrenaline rush, being on the darn ocean, the boats jumping up and down, looking at the moon, looking at the stars, the wind hitting you in the face. It was a certain amount of romance that went with this whole thing. You know, like the real true Pirates of the Caribbean. What these guys were feeling then, I'm feeling now. And what am I doing? We're beating the best system in the world. The defense line of the United States is the best defense line in the world. We're beating them and we're getting it through. That alone was a thrill. To just beat all these people, you know, and you're bouncing in there. Man, it's such a thrill to sit there being on a 40-something foot speedboat, and you don't go 100 miles per hour like you would see in a movie. You're going 30, 40, 50 miles per hour, 60 miles per hour. But you're hitting those waves, and you're just hitting the top. That boat is in the air half of the time. It's boom, boom. You got to develop grip. You have like a death grip on you. You can't sit down. If you sit down, you're going to break your back. So you're basically riding, you develop sea legs. You go up, down, up,
like
down.
Like riding a horse, but it's a
boat. Yeah, yeah, yeah. You roll with it, you know, and you're holding. Because if you don't grip the thing right, you're going to get thrown overboard. And then in that night sky, I mean, nobody's going to find you. There's no flares.
Sharks will find you.
Yeah, really, yeah, yeah, yeah. It probably would be the most humane thing. Because otherwise, you're going to be treading water for a long time. You're going to be suffering. So you might as well end it quick.
It's like a real life video game.
Oh yeah.
Like you're flying in a boat, it's smuggling, but it's real.
It's the real
thing. But you get that energy like you're playing, but the person you're playing is yourself.
You're on the edge, there's no downtime.
So that's addictive.
It's a hell of a thrill, it's a hell of a ride. And you get caught up in all that. At least I did, you know?
Yeah.
And so I would do it even for free. I used to sit there and say, man, look at this shit. I landed one time in the jungle and the people that are coming out, they have blow guns, they have no teeth. They're wearing loin cloth. You know, you were with the History Channel, right? I'm sitting there going, damn, man, look where I'm at. And I'm getting, and I'm making money. And I'm doing this thing. I do this thing for free. I'm dealing with these guys. Yeah, big iron bird, you know, this kind of, it was a thrill. It was experiencing things that, like I told one prosecutor, I'm the kind of guy that you pay money to go to the movies to see because you can't live my life. The guy said to me, you got a bad attitude. I said, you bring it on in me.
This is a prosecutor.
Yeah, prosecutor.
I bet your lawyer was happy.
Yeah.
Eventually, TJ has more money than he can ever spend, and all his millions are shrewdly invested, making him even more millions. So he starts pulling back on cocaine smuggling. You told Pablo you were getting out.
I first told his rep. He had a rep here in Miami. I said to him, man, I want to wind stuff down. You know, I want to quit, you know?
And why did you want to quit?
Because I met Veronique. And I wanted to do what my dad told me what it was all about, having a family and having children. And that's the one thing that I couldn't buy. I couldn't buy children, you know? And then I was around a lot of beautiful girls, a lot of beautiful girls. But Jonathan, I didn't want just beauty. I wanted DNA. I wanted small town upbringing.
She lit the spark in you to get out of the business.
Yeah.
And what was the plan in your mind?
The plan
what was
in
the
my
fantasy?
Mind was having my Lamborghini here and having a little miniature Lamborghini for my future son that she was going to give me. Her and I started looking at this other piece of property where he had a lake on a place called Davie. And I was buying like 20 acres there. And I was going to build a house with the garage for my little boy, car spot in my Lamborghini and like that.
And then what would you do for money?
What do you mean, what do I do for money? I own 12 businesses.
So you had enough money to just walk away from the cocaine?
I own the biggest dealership in the world.
So that was bringing in a ton of money.
I didn't really care what it was bringing in because I'm bringing in, I got accounts in Europe with millions of dollars.
So you had enough money in your mind. You didn't want to smuggle coke anymore.
No, I don't need any more money. I'm the biggest cell phone company of South Florida. You know, I have a construction business, 120 homes I'm building. Everything around me is paid for. My airplanes are paid for. All these airplanes, there's no loans anywhere. So I had an investment company. I had the bank, Jefferson Banks, on the contract. I was buying them. I had to already pick the board of director and everything for it. I have keys to four cities in the state of Florida. And I was invited for dinner with Reagan. I was a member of the Young Inner Circle Republican Party. Now I belong to one party, the Tito Party. And I leave all that politics out of my life because they're all a bunch of crooks. They're the ones that should be in prison.
Regardless, the fact remains. In early 1988, TJ wants out of cocaine smuggling. But Pablo Escobar and his company of cocaine cohorts are not happy about it. Not at all. And they push back.
They asked me, man, you know, what are we going to do? You know, blah, blah. They made it sound like you're our go-to guy. You're our money. So I told them, and by the way, before I said anything, I started slowing down the trips. I can't go. I got the plane in the shop. I'm waiting on another engine. I'm doing this. I'm doing that. So instead of popping them one a week, I'm now bringing it down to like maybe two trips a month. I don't need the cash.
And then are you getting fill-ins for your absences?
So that's what I told them. I said, what I'll do is I'll bring in other people. So you guys are not going to miss me. You know, and I'll always be here. The last thing I'm going to do is end this relationship on a bad note.
So you started not doing as many trips.
Right.
You started finding him other pilots to smuggle.
Yeah, yeah.
And you were getting out.
I was getting out.
And then knock, knock, agents arrest you.
And at the time of his arrest, TJ has some unfinished business in the Bahamas.
The day I got arrested, I left 1,000 kilos in Great Inagua.
Whatever happened to it?
I lost them. $30 million.
Someone took it.
I was gone.
Yeah.
I didn't come on until years later.
Wow.
Great Inagua. I left 1,000 kilos.
On the street, that 1,000 kilos of cocaine is worth hundreds of millions of dollars. I can only imagine what whoever found TJ's ton of coke did with it. Maybe they sold it and made a fortune. Maybe they turned it over to the police. Or maybe they just powdered their nose. Since TJ's been out of prison, he's been rubbing shoulders with some pretty impressive people, trying to get his new business, his new legitimate business, up and running. He's been meeting with consultants, investors, stockbrokers.
The stockbroker guy goes, all right, so listen, so you were in the cocaine business. A lot of people were in the drug business. A lot of people were. Not everybody made zillions of dollars like you. So you know what you show me? You know how to make money.
And whatever happened to all that money TJ made? He had tens of millions of dollars stashed all over the place, in the US and in Switzerland. I'm in TJ's car now. He's driving me around South Florida. We're gonna grab breakfast when he suddenly drops this on me.
I have $5 million in a house buried over there.
You had $5 million like buried in the ground?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, it was in somebody's living room with tiled over it. And it was for emergencies where I couldn't get the money from Switzerland quick enough over here.
And just where is all that money today? Find out on the next episode of Cocaine Air.
That was just for an emergency case that something drastic happened and I needed to get my hands on a couple of million dollars.
To see some incredible photographs documenting TJ's life, go to cocaineair.com. And if you're enjoying Cocaine Air, please hit that share button and text it to your friends and family right now. And if you feel comfortable, leave us a 5-star review. Reviews really help other listeners find us. Cocaine Air was created, written, and executive produced by me, Jonathan Walton, for Jonathan Walton Media. Executive producers, Evan Goldstein, and the inimitable TJ Dominguez. Audio engineering by me, Jonathan Walton. Sound design and editing for this episode was done by Mike Smith. And the Cocaine Air cover art is by Bobby Animation. We've got a lot of fascinating untold stories like Cocaine Air coming down the pike at Jonathan Walton Media, so subscribe and keep an ear out.